Welcome to another inspirational video segment. I'm sitting in the studio of Mitchell Johnson, one of my favorite painters. I've followed his work for a long time, but have never really had the nerve or courage to call him up and come down and see him. And he's been really generous today to let us do that. So I wanted to just dive into this, and maybe you can just give us a little bit the background. I know you went to Parsons, and just kind of a background of how you came to here, and then we'll dive into your work a bit.
So we're in the Bay Area in California.
Yes.
Which you didn't mention.
Yes, so, yes. Silicon Valley.
Right.
Redwood City.
Yeah.
Right, right.
Yeah, and I came to Silicon Valley in 1990 after finishing Parsons in New York.
Mm-hmm.
And it was just good luck that my brother lived in Palo Alto, and he said, why don't you move out here, you know, And strangely enough, he found me a job working for Sam Francis.
Oh, no kidding.
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
Which I didn't know if you knew about that. But
he actually called me.
I'm on the phone in Soho in Manhattan, and I'm done with grad school, and I don't really have a certain direction where to go next.
Uh-huh.
I've been doing some part-time jobs with all kinds of artists like Frank Stella and Saul LeWitt, and my brother Ed calls me, and he's like, yeah, somebody's moving out of the house in Palo Alto, and you know, it'd be really easy. You could just come out, and there's like a bedroom. You could start renting it next month. And I'd never been to Northern California, but I thought, this sounds kind of interesting. And I said, okay, just call me back. Get me a little part-time job and call me back. And I was just, I was interested, but I was kind of joking. And next thing you know, a few days later, he met somebody who was actually working in Sam Francis's studio in Palo Alto. And he calls me and he says, hey, you know, I really did find a job if you want to come to California. And it was so bizarre. And I called,
wow.
Actually called Saul LeWitt on the phone. And I said, I don't know what to do. You know, I want to just stay in New York and paint, but it's so expensive to get a space. And maybe that's not really the right thing for me to do. And my brother just called me and says that I can get this job with Sam Francis and move to California. And he said, well, I can't pay you to sharpen my pencils. You know, I just don't need anybody that much more right now. And you should go. And so Saul LeWitt actually said, go to California.
Wow, because that's a scary move, really. I mean,
yeah, in some ways, but then I could have just stayed for 2 months or, you know, 6 months.
Right,
but
right.
Anyway, so I came because of that opportunity. And I kept moving around. I sort of went back and forth between California and New York, and then California and Europe, mostly going to France to paint outside in the landscape.
Right, plein air, yeah.
Yeah, and I would paint outside in California, but I would also go into the garage at the house that we were renting and make little paintings with the, you know, I'm out there making a painting outside.
But you're doing small paintings, plein air, right?
Yeah, this was a big painting for me in the 90s.
Oh, no
kidding. And so I would sometimes paint outside paintings about half this size or even smaller. And, you know, you're mixing all those colors when you're outside, you're looking and you're mixing on your palette. And I'm making this landscape of California. And then you go back into the garage studio, and there's all these colors that you've used outside, and I wanted to keep working with them and see how they behaved and how they changed each other. And so I started making abstract paintings in the garage.
Derived from landscape painting.
Yeah, made from the colors that I mixed outside.
Yeah.
And I had done that in France a little bit too. At some point I just came back into my apartment and I realized I want to just keep going. I don't want to keep painting the motif I was standing
mm-hmm.
in front of, but
mm-hmm.
I definitely want to keep working with these colors. And it was a very natural thing. And in some ways, this movement, if there really is a movement, you know, between representation and abstraction, it goes way back.
Right.
And I actually, at Parsons, I even did that. I was in the studio with everybody else painting models who would come and set up for us. And then I would go over on the side sometimes and make paintings to try to see what happens when these little pieces of color maybe got a little bit bigger.
Did you find it challenging to take, that pivot from painting something you're looking at, which is damn hard to do, and then to go and take that into a studio and you're completely unhinged there? I mean, was that hard to learn that? It was for me. I mean, that led to my abstract work, but I started in a more realistic That was hard. How did you think about it? Was it just, I just want to use these great colors, and you started making things?
Well, I think it just naturally happened. Mm-hmm. I didn't think about it too much, but there's no question that I was painting outside, and I really needed to be in front of the motif or the landscape. When I went back inside, I didn't feel like I could continue the painting. Until I got back out there, I would wait and go back tomorrow and see the place again.
So you weren't modifying something. You would just take that and then you start another one with that color.
Yeah, in the beginning, I wasn't really continuing that particular painting when I got back inside. Yeah. But here was a chance to use all those colors to kind of, continue exploring what you had been looking at, but not directly in that same painting.
Uh-huh.
But that's not to say at all that the other painting felt like a study or felt like it was... I didn't feel that the other painting was even in service of that landscape that needed some solution or maybe mm-hmm. needed to change, mm-hmm. and I didn't know how. So, mm-hmm. But in terms of talking about what it felt like, I think it's important to say that slowly I started to feel like I could continue the painting that I'd been making from life or making outside. And in fact, I wanted to come back inside and put it up on a white wall or put it up on a wall where I could really see it more clearly, not outside.
And get back from it.
It wouldn't have the context of everything around it, that was going on where I'm standing in a parking lot or I'm standing in front of, a truck or something. Mm-hmm. So what I was painting outside and then what was happening with it when I was coming back into the studio was evolving at the same time that I was making these abstract paintings kind of in parallel to that experience. But slowly over time, not only did I get better at making a drawing or taking a photo that could serve something that I would work on in the studio, but just increasingly I felt like I wanted to be in here and to really see how the color was behaving. And I still look outside all the time, when I'm driving here from my house. I go to Italy and I make little drawings. Mm-hmm. Sometimes I paint outside. But there's a lot of things that I want to work on that I should be in here where I have...
this nice
daylight, and I kind of see how the painting is going to behave wherever it ends up going, whether it goes, mm-hmm. To somebody's house or my house or a gallery, wherever it goes,
right.
It's going to leave this warehouse, or it's definitely not going to be seen, outdoors. So I need to see
how it's going to be in its life.
What's really going on
like
with
this.
It? Yeah. So anyway, I moved here from New York, and I didn't expect to stay, but I met my wife and fell in love, and I stayed, because of her, really.
Oh, my God. Wow.
So, yeah.
Huh. Okay. So then, but when you moved out here and you were down in this area, were there many artists in this area? Did you have a community?
I occasionally met other artists, mm-hmm. Through different things that were going on, but... I just kind of did my own thing. I didn't really pursue other people that much. Yeah. It's not like I ever went out and painted in groups and things. And sometimes people will email me and say, I'm going out painting, and we even have this group. Maybe you'd like to join us. But that's never been something I could really do.
But you've been pretty much being able to focus on your art, and you were working with well-established artists.
Uh-huh.
To make money, and then you've been selling your work, and that's you haven't been distracted by you work for a software company or anything. You've been able to pursue this.
Yeah, well,
it's pretty unusual, right?
Yeah, I did go to college, and mm-hmm. at the same time I was studying drawing and painting and art history. I was taking philosophy and math and computers mm-hmm. and all kinds mm-hmm. of stuff, and I went. I worked at a computer job for 2 years in D.C. and went to art school at night at the Washington Studio School, in Georgetown.
Wow.
And it was the work I was doing at night that I got a portfolio together so that I could go to grad school at Parsons in mm-hmm. New York. But when I left Parsons in 1990 and moved here, I would occasionally do, paint a house for somebody or something.
Mm-hmm.
But it really was not long that after getting here that I started to sell a couple of paintings here and there. And I lived on very little, so if I could sell a painting... for $600 that I could get through the month, and spend a lot of time painting.
Yeah.
And I have been painting pretty much full time for more than 20 years or so. And so if my paintings are going anywhere, I've been very lucky to have, such a focus and all that time. I can't imagine figuring out a lot of what I've done
without
juggling it, even with teaching or because I did teach really briefly when I came to Palo Alto at the Pacific Art League and taught a couple of landscape classes with people who just signed up, and we would go meet and paint together. But I never felt like I went to grad school in order to get a degree so I could teach. It was always, I went to grad school because I wanted to know more about painting.
Yes.
And it just happens I got a master's along the way, kind of.
Yeah, right. So the abstraction, so when you came out here, you were already kind of working in this way.
The shapes were much more organic, kind of. They have become quite geometric, and I'm sure they're going to, you know, continue to change. But some of the abstraction that I was doing when I first got here, like around 90, 91, 92, it was much more kind of like early Diebenkorn, sort of de Kooning kind of stuff.
And
I was very concerned about the mark making as much as the color. And then it really departed to where it was almost just about the color. And where this is really important, and where this is really important. But I'm not quite as concerned about that you get something engaging going on in the surface by the type of brush stroke.
Right.
And that really did consume me for a long time. And I even had...
Yeah, I mean, mark making is, like, that's... You can spend your whole life doing that. I mean, when you said that, like, I'm not really concerned with mark making, I just thought, wow, like, what a relief in a way, you know?
Well, yeah, it's interesting.
It's like you just let go of... Because I am, and I mean, I'm very... almost to a fault. And I just... That's something why I think I'm drawn to your work, because it's just so... There's such an essence to it, and I didn't really understand until you just said that what... why that is, you know, because you... that's not what these don't have that, but it's so nice. So then that dropped away, and then it became more about space and color and surface, not so much surface, but just shape, which is a lot.
Well, there's, you know, there's space in this painting from the...
I mean, depth, I guess.
From
yeah.
these two colors, you know, interacting, or these three colors interacting, but there's also something happening with this is quite thin. This, you see some brush in it. This, you'd see the brush even more distinctly. And then, of course, this is a bit thicker. And, you know, that makes space.
Through the
difference, I don't know if mark making is really a word. The difference in the surface.
It's the density of the paint and the impasto.
And that goes back to the Corot landscapes that we were talking about before.
Yes, how you have, you know, the differences. So when you're working on this, and this is... You're still working on this?
No, this one... kind of... You know, this one's been going on off and on for like 3 or 4 years. And I actually changed and added this a couple days ago. And then this gray, purpley, kind of difficult to describe color is on top of something that was a more distinctly blue color. And it suddenly went from being feeling pretty exciting to becoming... kind of complex and mysterious in a way that I could never consciously go after. And that's when I always know the painting is getting close to being done, is when it usually ends up in a place that I never could have predicted.
Right.
But also it takes on a kind of... it feels like a complete thought somehow, even though it's not really a verbal conclusion that I come to, that it feels complete. But it always has a kind of something very immediate about it, but also something that feels really complex or unexpected or mysterious.
Yes, and it's not totally obtainable. Like, it's simple, but then it's also complex and challenging to kind of... Yeah, there's just a weightiness to it.
And I never know when that really happens, except that it rarely happens quickly. When I was at Parsons, on the wall in our huge studio, there were like 15 grad students, and we shared this big studio. And on the wall, there was a little slogan. It said, "Clarity and Surprise."
Wow.
And they had translated it, because all different students would come through the grad school. They had it written in, you know, like Korean and in Chinese and in Italian. And anybody who came, if it wasn't already there in their language, they had to add it. And when they would repaint the studio once a year to clean it up, they always left that little section.
That's fabulous.
But clarity and surprise,
right.
Or like accessibility and mystery.
Yes.
I mean, they're so verbal, but that's kind of the... They make for an emotional feeling, those two things.
Right, absolutely. So the difference is that you're... I mean, you're dealing with, when you're juggling, I mean, when you're making these, when you start, are you, first of all, this is oil, is that correct?
Yeah, this is oil. And this is, you know, the side of a building in Cape Cod that I've seen a bunch of times, and I even painted in front of.
Oh, okay, wow.
And this is another building that's kind of cropped in front of it, and it was actually quite representational initially.
So you're starting, you had a photo or
a photo,
you had
a drawing. Another little painting that I made larger. I mean, I partly made this larger because I had a little painting of this situation where you're looking through to this water, and I was really intrigued with, well, what grays and blues and yellows do you assemble to get something that vibrates the way this place did when I was looking at it? And I made a little painting that I felt good about, and I thought, well, what happens if I just increase the size of those colors and shapes? Because obviously it's going to change.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like when you have a little piece of red on this wall and then you put it there, they're not the same thing.
Exactly, right.
And so I made this bigger version of that small painting, and then sure enough, it didn't have any of the... It was very self-conscious, and you could feel that in the painting. There was something about it that wasn't convincing. And so it just kind of kicked around here in the studio like a lot of paintings do. And at some point I added, I think I probably added this thing in here, these two blues that are kind of like a towel or something. And,
yes.
And I thought, wow, can you really make a serious painting with a towel, you know?
Yeah, or this, you know.
Yeah, like, and then
oh my God.
Those are stripes, but maybe they were related to a chair, but it doesn't really matter, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Because either
well,
they're
the
going to
feeling.
Do...
It's the feeling that this gives us is like that feeling of that chair with that cloth on it. And that's what's so interesting about your work. Like, I didn't identify the building, but I've been to this place. And that's interesting to me that you get that feeling of a place, that light place. It's not Mexico. This isn't Mexico. It's somewhere else. But you're doing it just with rectangles and density of paint and colors and arranging them. When you're working on this, are you after that feeling of that place, or are you just...
Oh, no, really intuitive, and it's not verbal at all.
Yeah.
I mean, the idea of the place is a very verbal thing, and
yes.
And it's, I'm standing around in here, you know, pacing around, wondering what could I possibly do today. Sometimes driving over here, I'll think, okay, I'm really ready to go back to a certain painting, and sure enough, I get here and I start on that painting, but... plenty of days I come in and it's just like, this is where I'm going to be, you know, from 9 to 5, and I get here and I sort of see what happens. You know, there's that video of Agnes Martin in her studio, and she says that a lot of the time she would just sit down and wait 10 minutes or wait 2 hours for inspiration to come, and she would actually get a vision, and she usually used that vision to make a thumbnail or a small
mm-hmm.
drawing that was very considered, you know, using math and all this kind of stuff. And then she was ready to go make the painting that was like a vision that came to her. And she said that the painting is, you know, it's emotion. It's pure emotion. It's just not verbal emotion.
Right,
and,
right.
And I absolutely agree with that. And I know that people attach themselves to, oh, wow, I love that because it's Cape Cod and I love Cape Cod. And that's powerful. That's mm-hmm. sentimentality.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we dismiss that, but that's powerful stuff, you know?
Sure.
Well, and I think the older you get, the more powerful it becomes.
Yeah, and there's a quality of light and outdoorsness that this has. It doesn't necessarily mean that you're painting Cape Cod, but that those feelings come in this, that... That is, it's abstracted in a way, but it comes across.
It's emotional.
Yeah.
It's really emotional.
Yeah, yeah,
and
yeah, yeah.
Like the painting of Manhattan that's behind you.
Right.
I was in a hotel, and I had no idea that I was going to get so intrigued by the shapes and the stuff that was out the window.
I mean, great patterns, right? All kinds of great vertical, horizontal stuff interacting, and I have to decide to what extent does it become, you know, really descriptive or representational, and that's intuitive. You know, I just kind of start and dive into it with a certain feeling about it, and then I see where it goes, and I see, you know, if maybe I add this and it wasn't there, or maybe I overly generalize this part or that part, or
right.
Anyway, it kind of evolves. It goes through this process, and I really felt like it was done. I even reproduced it in a little catalog or something and even offered it to somebody. You know, they didn't buy it, I still have it. And then I changed it. It was all this dark blue here.
Wow.
And I put this weird gray that almost acts like silver in here more recently. And I really thought that the dark bluish sky did something interesting and made the buildings kind of luminous or made them intriguing because it was such a big flat shape. But yet it never really felt mysterious to the point that that I didn't want to touch it, you know? And so one day I was mixing this gray on another painting and I just thought, oh my God, what if I masked that in over here? And it's this very kind of impulsive, compulsive, intuitive thing. And so this was put away and I'd mix this color for something else. I take it out and lo and behold, after it's sitting around for like 6 months, it becomes this other thing that now I think somehow it became quite mysterious. I mean, it's obviously Manhattan, but...
Well, and that, you know, there's that background sky thing really coming up. All of a sudden, it's like a piece of a puzzle piece coming forward with that thicker, impossible sky. And this is somewhat has much more density than your other things. Like, I feel like we can zoom in to pieces of this, but it's kind of great. It has this complexity that your other things, you know, usually they're much more simplified, you know.
Yeah, that's a painting with a whole lot of little marks or, you know, I don't even think about it as detail so much as little shapes.
Yes. Complexity.
They're very different. You know, this is a totally different painting from that
totally
painting.
Totally different, yeah.
Because of the scale of the shapes and the decisions become so different.
And next thing you know, this trip where we were just staying in this hotel to do something else became the source of a number of paintings. But it's, you know, it's so much about New York on the one hand, and then it's all about these particular shapes that I use to build a painting.
Right.
And
right.
Somehow those shapes have a powerful emotional resonance for me. And I understand people see it and they're like, wow, that's Manhattan. I love that. I even know that building. You know, I want that painting. But I think on some level they're actually having a much deeper experience. And
well, it's
not
the arrangement of shapes, I think, ultimately, that you respond to first.
Yeah.
Then it's a picture of a deer or whatever. It's the arrangement of those and the differences of things that are curated and put together in a way that is powerful. More powerful, in fact, than just glancing up maybe and seeing it out in the world.
Mm-hmm.
And so when you're taking something, whether it's realistic or not, and you're putting it, arranging it all, what I love about that is that somebody can just come along and they don't have any understanding necessarily of what you're doing, but they just feel it. It's like great music. They just say, I love that. I got to have that. Or I connect to that.
Yeah.
You're hitting them. They feel it, but they don't necessarily know why. I mean, we have to know why because we're trying
maybe,
to figure
well,
it out.
Well, maybe we have to know
why.
We
have to understand something of how to, like, we got to say yes or no to this. Try it and then get rid of it, right? You know,
that's beautiful that we're kind of segueing into this discussion about editing because the whole painting is just a bunch of choices that of what you leave in and what you take out. But I think you operate on those decisions or choices in a nonverbal way at some point.
Sure, I mean you're going.
So I mean something has to happen where. Of course, you draw from life, and you draw from life, and you look at other people's paintings, and you study art history, and you look at the world, and you get better and better at looking. And I think part of what that does is it kind of unwinds your acculturation to how you make sense of the world. Because we go down the street, and you just identify everything. You don't really look at it.
Yes,
because looking takes time. And
you have to get
your kid to school, and
you
got to get the car over to be
you're
repaired.
You're a bit asleep at the wheel. You're just seeing, there's that thing again. You're not really looking at that mailbox.
I mean,
color.
Paying attention takes it takes energy.
Yeah.
And we don't always have the energy available, so we identify everything. But when you really look at things, I remember my teacher, Joe, at the Washington Studio School said, you know, the still life, it's all right there. You just can't see it.
Uh-huh.
But the still life is telling you everything.
Yeah.
You can't see it. And it's very hard to imagine that you can look with a fair amount of energy and attention and yet not see everything that's going on. But, you know, Giorgio Morandi, Joseph Albers, Corot, Matisse, all these artists who I like, all their paintings are about paying attention and about how we see. They're not so much about how things look. I mean, there's a kind of realism out there that you come across, and the realism is about how things look. It's about like appearances, but in a known way, and with conventions about how do you make the pair go behind another pair, and how do you make the railroad tracks go into deep space to communicate distance.
Yes.
And this is convention. I mean, we see it and it works on us, but we don't pay attention to the fact that, oh, wow, I learned that. You know? Like, I learned that that's yellow. That doesn't tell me that's yellow. I learned that. And so this is kind of convoluted, but my point is that when you're really looking at things, you're not identifying them. You're looking at them, and you can actually see what it is about them that could serve your painting or help you in your painting or lead to a painting. Painting that's about really paying attention and looking is very different than painting that says, oh, look at how well I can paint.
Yeah, or, of course.
Oh,
right.
Look at
yes,
how
right.
I know how to make the figure
right.
appear beautiful or appear proportional.
Yes.
And this isn't a judgment call, but I do want to draw attention to that those are two different things.
Yes. Yes.
But in general, I think the public believes that artists and painters are trying to make convincing images and that their paintings on the wall to evidence their skill. But I would argue that the paintings on the wall as an opportunity to think about how you experience the world, which is very different than saying the painting's there because that person is really good at what they do or
right.
got really good by studying. I'm saying the painting is there, whether it's a Frank Stella or even a Saul LeWitt or a Joseph Albers. It's there to give you a chance to say, wow, do I really know how to pay attention?
Right, or right.
Do I really look at things or do I just identify them?
Right. I like to describe, you know, the standard I use when I'm, you know, the challenge is to push ourselves and try to go further. And what I do when I'm working is I try and I ask myself, does this create a state of wonder for somebody? And it's, you know, it's like I can do things that are pretty good and people are going to like them, but will it stop somebody and just change their day? You know, that kind of standard. And I think that's kind of what you're talking about. You know, it's just, it's really a much bigger ask. It's challenging, you know, but that's what I use that to, it just pushes me. It just pushes me to go further. And it's, I'm not entirely sure when I'm making it, like, I don't even know totally. Do you know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
Yeah.
One of my teachers from New York said, when you go to the studio, you should do what you don't know how to, what you don't know what you're doing or you don't know how to do.
Yeah.
It isn't, you don't go and make the still life over and over again because you know how.
Yeah.
You go and try to do something you don't know.
Yeah.
Again, I think that could be pretty confusing as an idea for people who don't go to a studio every day.
But that idea of like how you finish a painting, we want to have that feeling in it. I mean, we were talking earlier about how, you know, it's got a, there's all the, you know, academic things that we love that we want to have in there, but then it's got to feel almost just slightly out of reach for you, you know, just, do you work at that, I mean, do you think about it that way when you're working to have something finished? I mean, it sounds like you work on these paintings. Are they all several years, kind of? I mean, are you?
I'd say in general, most of them are more than a year. But
no kidding.
It's hard to really say because sometimes I'll work on one for a week or so, and it really feels like okay. I mean, increasingly, it feels like I can get closer to some things pretty quickly that before were just totally elusive, and I can get to them. But then usually, if I can spend time with the painting, I back up a bit, and I don't so much second guess as I think, I feel that the painting could go further and could become something else. And a lot of the time, I need that initial confidence and clarity to get the painting started. And then you actually see it through pretty far, and yet, oh, it's not it. This composition, these colors don't have quite the magic that I really believe they did. But it's a good
initially,
thing.
Right.
It's a good thing you thought that because otherwise you'd never get started.
Right. You have to. It's. I mean, I see. Like, for me, it's objectivity. I can't see it after a while, and I work in multiples. You know, six or seven at a time. But that's to have, to you know, you lose objectivity, but you're also learning. I mean, I'm actually learning as I'm going, and I can't make the move until I've learned. You know, you have to get the painting to a certain point, and then you're going to make that. That's how you learn. You can't make that next step until you've done that.
But that's like the way you tell your kids, you have to get started on a path, right? And you have to take a part-time job to find out.
You will find your way as you go.
What you might not want to do.
Yeah.
And that helps you find out what you do want to do. And you said you work on multiples. I bet a lot of the time, one painting helps you find the solution for something else, right? I mean, I could be working on that, and then I mix this yellowish ochre, and I suddenly realize that's what would have, if that was over here, that's what would have made all of these kind of come together.
Yes.
So a lot of the time, one painting will lead to a solution for another one, or not even a solution. It will lead to that really unexpected thing that you wouldn't have done otherwise that makes that painting kind of turn a corner and become mysterious, you know?
Yeah. I also think there's something about when you're focused on this one painting and out of the corner of your eye is the thing you were working on earlier, there's a dialogue still happening over there.
Your subconscious is still working on the other one.
Yeah.
I think sometimes it's fooling you and getting you to go
and
work on this to mix that color that it knows will solve that, will enhance that other painting.
Yeah, totally. I mean, do you get that where it's like you feel like someone's teaching you or that like it's your intuition really is what we're talking about. I mean,
it does feel like they're two
people
a lot of the time.
Yeah.
The more conscious person working and then somebody else driving that person maybe in the background. Yeah.
Right, like that answer is there, and you silly guy, you're just going to have to do this for a couple of days. But if you could just look to your left, it's sitting there.
Right.
If you could just trust yourself. I mean, that idea of intuition, are you, for me, I'm using that, like, that's just taking over for me. I'm just trusting that more and more and more.
Mm-hmm.
That's just for myself. Are you finding that in you know your evolution that it's more right than not? I mean, when you're making some of these, are you just? I think this just feels right, and you're just intuition is driving it more, but it fits in with what you're doing, and it works more often, or.
Well, you know, I think it can become too intellectual to try to evaluate what's working and what isn't,
mm-hmm.
or to even talk too much about strategies.
Mm-hmm.
But I think the best strategy is to show up 5 days a week.
That it's a practice,
and to go through the two shitty days. So you have three good ones.
Yeah.
Because I think usually you get, or even if you go through three shitty days to get the two good days, you have to have, my only strategy is you better have some time to waste or burn, or like Agnes Martin sits in that chair for 2 hours waiting for the inspiration.
Yeah.
You know, don't check your phone for 2 hours. But everybody I think comes to some conclusion about, you know, you either listen to Mozart or you don't, and you either have two cups of coffee or you have one or you don't have any. I mean, everybody knows what helps you come to the studio and feels and maybe works for this week to help you be engaged
and be
ready to pay attention. And I don't think there are that many. I don't think there's really an answer. It's a pain in the ass. I mean, you have to figure out week by week.
Yes.
You can, like, my wife is a writer, and she listens to this wonderful discussion with Stephen King about, here's some things you might consider if you're trying to write a book or trying to write a novel or trying to finish your novel.
See what works for you.
You know, things about, you know, separating yourself from everybody else and going down into a room and not having the window, gorgeous view out the window of the ocean. You know, you're trying to go into this place and yourself.
Yeah.
And, what she's doing when she's writing is probably very close to what I'm doing when I'm coming here and trying to pay attention. And it's definitely interesting to hear what other people go through and how they access these kind of magical moments.
Yeah, yeah.
And I read about other artists and their careers, and I look a lot at art history. I love to watch documentaries about musicians and to hear about their roller coasters that they go up and down on.
Right.
And as they're, you know, they have an album that's out in the world, and yet they're writing the songs for the next album, and you're juggling, you know, this kind of awareness of people paying attention to your work or talking about it, and yet you're trying to have this private experience. And I think, you know, hearing what other people have done to get through difficult parts can really help, but maybe not always other painters. Maybe it's really good to watch documentaries about writers or about...
Right. And I love how you describe it. It's just paying attention. You're trying to set up conditions to pay attention.
Yeah.
To be more alive, to feel, just heighten the sensitivity.
Yeah.
You know, and I like that's this whole thing with, you know, the art tends to get better because you get more sensitive the more you do it, you know.
Like, I don't really, not to be, sound judgmental, but I don't see myself painting outside with five or six other people because I'm really having trouble on my own just to be present
right.
when I'm there.
Right.
And,
yeah.
And I even have one of my older teachers told me that he never listens to music when he paints, and I listen to a lot of music when I paint.
Well, you had it back in your childhood. There was, your mother was a musician.
Yeah, she was a piano teacher.
Wow, and, so that was a big part of your, 'cause, so do you have a, is this pretty varied, your musical?
Oh, it's all over the place.
Yeah, I would think so.
Yeah, everything from, you know, like Chet Baker to rap and
do you mix it? Like, do you just do that random play? I do this in workshops. I've got a really eclectic...
Sometimes I like to listen to college radio sometimes, so I don't really know what's going to come
up.
And they often surprise me with something that can really help. And other times I really think, okay, I definitely am going to listen to Elliott Smith for 2 hours this morning, and I know that that's going to help me because I'm having a crappy day, and that's going to help.
Mm-hmm.
So it... again, it really varies a lot, and... I'm open to a variety of things that, you know, could help.
Right, right.
Yeah.
Using that, you know, taking the energy from the music, you can, like, depending on what you need.
Sure.
Again, it's like, what do I need here? What other thing, conditions do I need so I can do this?
Well, I definitely know that there are aspects of my paintings when they feel complex and when they feel right to me, is something quite similar to various songs that I would have heard as a teenager or, you know, in my 20s. And the song, the emotion and the immediacy, the sort of clarity of that feeling I got from certain songs is something I'm trying to tap into.
And
the paintings really feel like a visual equivalent to that emotion that I hear from the music. And There's a powerful connection to music for certain.
Yeah. You know, I was interested in, you know, when I was looking at something you do, and I see this in Morandi's work, this idea of space. And what I love about his work is, I mean, that background is the foreground and the foreground's the background and all this, but it's this edge of there's space and then there's not space. And you do that really well. But I don't totally understand that. Or are you aware of what I'm talking about? Like, why that's so powerful, that background comes up and we see it. It's almost like we see it. We're seeing a still life and we're seeing the pieces of the still life.
Yeah, you're very aware that somebody made this.
Yes. But it's also a still life and there's that play back and forth. It's not like a photograph of still life.
Yeah, there's a...
it's like a plastic.
There's an integrity of the two-dimensional surface.
Yes.
He never really is trying to convince you that this is supposed to be something, you know, that you see as being realistic or... as three-dimensional.
But it references it, and we say, oh, this is a place, this has depth, this is a real place, and then it's also flat. And there's this line you walk. You do it.
Yeah, well, if I walk it, it would definitely be something that I got from his work. He should get credit for that, because it was something that he made me aware was... significant in painting.
Yeah.
Should you achieve that, or should that happen in the painting? And, various teachers showed me Morandi over and over again, and I just never, I was like, why are we looking at this guy?
Yeah.
It meant zero to me, absolutely zero. And But, you know, they kept showing, and then I'd bump into it, and it took years, and then all of a sudden it starts to reveal itself. But every time I see one in life, it still reveals even more.
Yeah.
And this thing about, you know, going back and forth is, again, it's this reminder of, well, how do you put the world together?
Yeah, right,
and that you are putting it together, you know?
Yeah.
That you are assigning three-dimensionality to things if they have them. I mean, like the way that, you know, the little kids, they do all that research on at what point do they realize, you know, when you put the block out of sight behind somebody's head, is it still back there?
Uh-huh.
Does that person have a back to their head? Because,
right.
You know, you are so two-dimensional to me, really.
Yes,
and
yes.
When I find you to be three-dimensional, it's all my neurology assigning that.
Uh-huh. We know the back.
But it happens so, it's so fluid the way that it happens that you don't even pay attention or know that you're doing it, that you're assigning all this three-dimensionality to things.
Right.
And like Alice Neal, you know, who makes those crazy, very kind of uncomfortable paintings of people.
Yes.
But they're so realistic on some level when you get away from ideas of convention of what does a portrait look like.
They feel more like the people than the people.
Yeah.
But it's an abstract painting, really.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And that,
yeah.
You know, Alice Neal is connected to that thing of Morandi. And if Morandi is doing that, it's only because you got to a point that you could find that in his work. I think plenty of people miss that.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, that's testament to how much you pay attention. Because I think a lot of people just, Morandi just...
Right, it's like, well, they're just
zero.
Muted color, it's a still life.
Yeah.
Right, right.
Yeah.
You know, I think, now I think about it, when you, those are differences, right? When you put two things that are different next to each other, it has a juice. And I think that idea of this, that it's spatial, that this is a still life, and then it's flat and it's a piece of, it's color and it's texture and it's surface and it's been painted and it's flat. Those are opposite ideas that are coexisting, and I think that's part of, I'm always organizing things in terms of, you know, why things look good and why I'm attracted to it and why it moves me. And you have a lot of this in your work, but that idea, that's a conceptual idea. But those are opposites, and that's really interesting. So we are hit with the fact that, oh, I've seen that, I know that, I can smell that room that Morandi's in, and then it's like, oh yeah, but this is like canvas and it's paint and it's the background's more in front of, you know, all the bottles are lining up with the horizon line, and it's like flat and it's folding in front of my eyes, you know.
It's in flux.
Yes, yes, yes.
It's in
flux. It's in flux.
But that's because really, all we do is make conclusions, right, about how things look or what they are when we identify them.
We're trying to lock it up, but can't.
Right, and what he's saying is it's always in flux. And Joseph Albers is saying that too. He's saying everything is in flux, and whatever your conclusion was about it when you saw it is all a result of the context of that moment. And that, you know, if you look at his painting and you see it one way and you see it another way the next day, of course, because every day is different. I mean, it's kind of an exhausting position because it's basically saying that if you really pay attention at that level, or if you really consider the world in that way, then it's pretty hard to get to work on time, and it's pretty hard to get down the street and do all the things you have to do in your day-to-day life.
Right.
So it's very contrary. Like, I remember this painter in New York who was at an opening one time, and she said, I've been painting so much, like, every day for 2 weeks straight, and I feel so stupid, and I just can't even talk to anybody. And I think, and it wasn't that she was painting really with a brush in her hand. It's that she was looking as she was painting and paying attention and considering how we make sense of the world to the point that it was unraveling
her
all of these
day to day.
It's unraveling our. You know, you are so conditioned to know how to drive over here and meet with me and to talk to me and to get to get down the street and do your errands that we're just not aware at the level at which we've sort of tuned ourselves to be able to do things. And again, it's not really about being present or paying attention or looking at things carefully. And so when you start to look at things carefully, you know, we have limitations. And
things are given up.
You're jettisoning some of your abilities.
Yeah. I get that.
I remember being at a party and this cat came and jumped in my lap. And I said to the person whose house I was in, I was like, oh, this is such a sweet cat. Where's the kitten? Where's the other cat? And they go, what are you talking about? And I said, well, I saw a kitten earlier. And they said, we don't have any kittens. And this big cat is sitting in my lap. And earlier, the same cat had walked through the hallway over there, like 20 feet away. And I hadn't scaled it up. And I had actually seen a kitten.
Uh-huh, yes.
And all that time, I thought, oh, they have a kitten. And if the big cat had never come and sat in my lap, I would have left and just said, oh, yeah, they have a kitten. But imagine, like, all day we're doing that, but there's never the moment to revisit or to find out that, oh, wow, we got it wrong. That was actually a 18-year-old person instead of a 30-year-old person. But we didn't really look that carefully, and we quickly decided they're 30.
Yeah.
But they were actually 18. Yeah. I mean, we do that all day.
We're a little asleep at the wheel.
Well, we're just, we're identifying. I mean, your brain is always anticipating because that's how we find food and survive. It's always anticipating. It's never really paying attention to what's happening so much as it is anticipating what's about to happen. That's human nature. Always involved in 1 second, 5 seconds down the road from where we are.
Right.
And painting requires you to be right here, right now, and not keep thinking, well, what's about to happen?
Right. Or how am I going to get this? Yeah, that whole thing of if you, you just being completely present is the strongest likelihood that you're going to make something worthwhile, you know. You start thinking about what you've made before.
Yeah.
You start thinking about how you want this thing to turn out.
Sure.
You're done. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Now you've had, I just want to touch upon it, you know, you've got your work in a lot of museums. Was this something that, I mean, this gives you a lot of momentum, was that something that you've, that's a hard thing, like you get so focused in your art and then to try to find places for it to end up, it's going to be beneficial for your career, and how have you been able to manage being completely present in the studio and also, you know, the business aspect of this or the importance of having the right gallery or the decision to sell your work directly or where you're going to advertise and if you are going to advertise and, you know, do you have that segment? Do you have that other hat? And when did that kick in or how do you pull that off?
It's a separate hat. You just said, do I have another hat? It is.
Yeah.
Those are two different hats.
Because they're really, really different.
They're very different.
Yeah.
Although paying attention really helps also when you're trying to decide where does the painting go in the world? How do I feel about that? What are my boundaries for? Is it the right place? And things like that. And I think that it's enormously complex, and everybody has to figure out their own way to negotiate exhibiting and selling and all the things that happen with your painting if it leaves the studio. I think there are plenty of people who, like Jess, who lived in San Francisco and just, you know, even
just made art,
just gave people money to go to the store and get sandwiches and never stepped foot out of the house and didn't really meet with people, as I understand, and just made paintings in the house and couldn't go outside of the house. And that's one solution, you know, if you're lucky enough to have somebody who will go outside of the house and do all these things. If you're not, you have to find some other way. And I think one of my teachers in New York said, my teacher Leland Bell said, you know, don't be a snob about where you exhibit and don't feel like you have to stay in New York. You know, maybe you're going to leave New York and you're going to go somewhere and teach a little bit and paint and show your paintings. And, you know, if your paintings are genuine and they're what you want them to be, then hopefully they're going to speak about that on their own. And anyway, he kind of freed me in some ways to say, that would be
still
great.
About the work.
Well, yeah,
work.
And it would be great to have a show on 57th Street in New York, but don't get confused that, you know, the show in the library in Palo Alto on some level is the same thing. You're just giving people a chance to come across your work.
Yeah,
I mean, hopefully they have good light. Hopefully the color of the wall isn't pink. So
I mean, you're
going to
make sure that it's not going to take the work down. Yeah.
But, you know, I was very lucky because I was showing and I made a lot of effort to send my slides out, you know, really early. And to go to openings.
So you approached museums
yourself.
I did
things to be in touch with people. And I but it was always important, I think, to identify a place where they, you know, like, you don't want to go to a gallery that sells and shows sculpture and say, will you show my painting?
Right, right.
Unless maybe, you know, they have a big wall and they want to start showing painting too. And mm-hmm. You want to think a bit about where your painting's going to go. You want to go around and see what other people are doing and get ideas about what seems right for you or what seems that you're comfortable with. But I do want to make this point that you also have to be fortunate enough that something clicks and something happens to you. The painter Sandro Chia had a big show at Spironi Westwater in New York in the 80s, and they didn't know that Mick Jagger was going to come to the opening and David Bowie and all these people. It was like serendipitous. All these people happened to come and buy a painting, and then suddenly he wasn't just this painter from Italy occasionally selling a painting. He was like a star or something.
Right.
But that's not going to happen to most of us, right?
Right.
Unless you're just lucky to be in the right place at the right time. I mean, Sandro Chia will tell you, he said this, I heard this, it's kind of like I won the lottery, all right? Everybody's out there painting. You guys are all trying hard. You're being yourselves. I was myself. My paintings happen to be.
Mick Jagger buys a painting.
Yeah, and then
it's on the news.
And then so what if that isn't going to happen to you and you want your paintings in the world? You have to look around and find places where you might be able to show them. And it just happens I was lucky to have paintings in a restaurant in Palo Alto at the same time that I was showing on 57th Street in New York.
Wow.
And both things
That's
were
so
working,
great.
You know?
Yeah, right.
But I wasn't a snob and said, oh, well, now I'm showing in New York. I would never show in this restaurant.
Right,
but
this is beneath
this
me.
Restaurant in Palo Alto, all these people went there from Silicon Valley and Stanford, and they started to buy my paintings.
Yeah.
And so when my dealer in New York was having trouble and the gallery was transitioning and then he actually passed away, I had this other thing that because I...
That you had, had chosen.
Well, that I... Yeah, yeah, and I'd curated and decided to participate in And maybe all those people went to New York, but they were busy in New York. And they,
right,
and I even
right.
said, go to the gallery, and they didn't have time.
Right,
and lo and
right.
behold, they come back to the restaurant and say, I'd like that one. Can I just buy it? And so I was lucky to have paintings in front of a lot of people in Silicon Valley. Well, and then they start to sell, and then I'm thinking, well, how can I, you know, use some of this resource of the money from people buying my paintings to make sure that they get further out into the world so that maybe this could continue and not just last for 1 year. And so I took risks with some of the money, and I, you know, put a catalog in the New York Times and did things that nobody's ever done.
And, right. That's I've been watching you do that. And it's just, I mean, if the idea is, which I think it is to expose people to the work and have them experience this, I mean, that's fabulous.
It's a catalog. It's a reproduction. It's not the painting.
Right.
But at the same time, it's an invitation. It's like a message in a bottle, and you don't know who's gonna open it.
Yeah, but you put prices in there, and some things that, you know, a lot of galleries won't even put prices on, which I love. It's like, this is the price of the work.
Well, I just wanted to simplify it.
Yeah, totally. And well, it's just honest, and it's, you know, did you have galleries that were like, whoa, I mean, it didn't matter?
With the internet, the whole gallery world has transitioned, and unless you were fortunate enough to have somebody who really was going to, you know, kind
of
carry your work and your career down the stream with them, you really have had to find out other ways. But I also learned things, you know, like I would see someone have a really major exhibit in New York and find out that they put the catalog together for the show.
Right.
Because the gallery is swamped, you know, with all of these things going on.
Yeah.
And I was like, really? And I thought, well, of course they put the catalog together so they could really make sure the reproductions were great.
And
make sure the paintings that were in the catalog were the ones they wanted in the catalog.
Like, and you have a book. You have that beautiful book you're looking at. You probably created that?
Well, that was... I worked with a whole bunch of people on these different things that went into the book.
Mm-hmm.
So it's definitely this... it's very much like a group project. But the beauty of doing the book wasn't just that I had to really say which paintings are who I want, which paintings tell the story that I want to tell.
Yes.
Which paintings should make the cut, kind
mm-hmm,
of.
Mm-hmm.
Which paintings, the book becomes a curating opportunity to really consider what's going on with your work and how you want it to come across on some level by which paintings you include in the book, right?
I mean, the process of making that is totally clarifying.
But I also wanted to clarify with the book how much these other paintings and painters have been important to me, that I wouldn't have become who I am if I'm doing something that right. other people really should get credit. So
yeah.
I included all that art history stuff that you saw in the book.
Yes.
And then in the process of licensing reproductions by other people, I met all kinds of curators and registrars. And so I was suddenly talking to all these museums and all these sources.
Oh, wow.
So the book became...
Oh, my God.
The book became a wonderful moment of interacting with art world people, which is a great compliment to the solitary time in the studio.
Yes, yes, yes.
And so I would have a day in the studio painting all day by myself, and the next day I might be on the phone and emailing with different people for licensing images or for talking to somebody who might be writing an essay for the book. And it was a way of providing some structure for my career
uh-huh.
and for my studio practice
mm-hmm.
that otherwise I'm just here in this warehouse
yeah.
in Silicon Valley in isolation.
Yeah.
And I know that the paintings get into the world because people make effort, and
right,
so it was a
right,
way for me
right.
to try to see them go into the world in a fashion that I felt good about.
Mm-hmm.
And all these people had collected the work, and the book was a way to thank them.
Because they get a book.
The book was,
their paintings are in
the
there,
book.
Maybe. Yeah.
It protects the provenance of their painting.
Right, right.
It does a lot of things that I don't want to be like overly intellectual or overly aware of what it does. But I go to openings and I've seen people's careers and I know what these different steps mean and what they do.
Yeah.
But none of that would matter if you didn't have some work that you wanted to make or some kind of aesthetic position that you felt strongly about.
Right.
So I see all these young people coming out of grad school or BFA programs, and they're definitely putting the cart before the horse. I mean, you gotta kind of figure out who you are, and that takes a while. And I sound like the old man saying, to the 24-year-old, don't do that, or,
yeah,
or how could you know who you are? I think the main thing is to really be in love with writing or painting or music. Be in love with what you're doing.
Yeah,
and then you'll find a way because it matters to you.
Right. You have to care and you have to be passionate and you have to be engaged. Yeah. And it holds you. It just, you keep going even on hard days and you can just keep showing up and it just builds on it and builds on it and builds
yeah.
on it.
But I also want to be really frank that it helps me that a museum just took a small painting, that somebody...
Yeah.
donated to them. That feels awesome.
Oh, it's
and
totally
it's, and it,
great.
It kind of solves this problem of being overly conscious about, does this matter? What I'm doing, does it even matter? And it's not like they've said, oh, yes, it matters. But you kind of just say, oh, yeah, that one went into that museum, and now it's feeling pretty positive. You don't overly analyze it.
Yeah.
You don't get too involved
right.
in it.
Right. You don't totally pick it up.
But it kind of, it does.
It. Yeah.
The best thing is it just removes this thing uh-huh. that otherwise could be polluting the studio.
Yeah, I get it.
Like a preoccupation.
Yeah. Right, right.
And in some ways, I sell the paintings and I try to get them out into the world so that I won't wonder too much about, where are these going to go?
Uh-huh.
Who's going to take care
yeah.
of these?
It's a necessary piece. I mean, not necessarily necessary, but it dovetails really nicely into making art, where they are being moved out. The outside
sure.
world's coming in, and then you see the work going, and
sure.
then you've got an empty space. I mean, I love
but, you know,
that.
As you've seen, there are other paintings here, and there's plenty that there's some I want to keep.
You right,
know, there's some
right.
that I like have set aside for my son, and there's some that I know that painting was the most significant painting that I made in 2003, and
yeah.
There's no way I'm going to sell it to somebody. Because it's something that I can always go back to and
yeah,
say,
yeah. It's a use,
does this
use.
Painting now have any chance of doing something special like that one did?
Uh-huh, right.
And so those other paintings, it's good to have them around because they help me,
Yeah, yeah, yeah. It's they're the tools to moving forward.
Yeah.
It's all about what you can do next, the next thing you're going to make.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
But it's a very complicated thing. It's a big thing to try... to articulate to somebody else.
Who's not involved in it. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah.